Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, gardening with horticulturist Roberta Clark. Good morning, Roberta.
Good morning, Mindy.
So we have had some rain, but still not enough to really make a big difference in our mild drought, right?
Well, you know, it's very frustrating. The rest of the Cape is drowning in rain, literally.
You mean the state.
And yeah. I watch the radar with every storm, and it all just sort of skirts just west of the canal. Mm-hmm. I was hopeful yesterday because we had a lot of very ominous-looking dark clouds. And we finally did get a sprinkle last evening, but we had 0.03 of an inch.
Very little.
So it's a friend of mine was saying, well, we've had lots of rain, and I beg to differ. I said, we've had lots of days where it's damp, where we're in a fog, where there might be a little bit of drizzle, but there's no accumulation and our soils are fairly dry.
Yeah. So we've talked about this before, but it's good to revisit. Let's talk about best watering practices.
Infrequently, but deeply. So not every day, not every other day, maybe twice a week, and run your sprinkler for as long as it takes to put down a minimum of 0.5 inch. And you can determine that by just getting some inexpensive rain gauges at your favorite garden center or hardware store and placing them out within the area that the sprinkler covers and measure how long it takes to get 0.5 inch. An inch is better than 0.5 inch, but if you're doing it twice a week, that should be sufficient. You might want to check with your local water company. My water district in the town of Barnstable has put out an advisory. It's not mandatory, and we don't want it to be mandatory, but people should try to do it as much as they can, and basically we're on a odd even day, mm-hmm. and they would prefer if you could water before 5 o'clock or after 8 p.m. Which is a little difficult for a lot of people unless you have an automatic system, but basically water very early in the morning or very late in the day, but not ever in the middle of the day when the sun is out, and most of that irrigation water will be lost to evaporation.
Yeah.
So good deep soakings once or twice a week, early in the morning or late in the day, those are the best practices.
And you'd be surprised when you get a rain gauge. You know, a lot of people say, well, we had so much rain, but you think you got a lot of rain. And then you go out and you look at the rain gauge and you go, what?
I actually have a little digital weather station outside, and so it's fairly accurate, and we'll have an entire day of misty drizzle stuff, and I'm going, oh, you know, it's horrible out, I can't work in the yard, but at least I don't have to water, and then at the end of the day, I look at the total, and it's in the not even the tenth of an inch, it's in hundredths of an inch, so that's totally inadequate for good plant growth. We were lucky we got a lot of rain. What was that? My memory has to go back. I think it was Memorial Day weekend. Yeah. We had a ton of rain, and it gave the ground a really good soaking that we were desperate for at that point because May was very dry. The rest of June was pretty dry. Over the 4th, we had some moisture coming down. But since then, really, you know, you watch the Boston weather stations, and it's rained every single day. Not on Cape Cod.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it seems to have missed us. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have garden questions, tips, questions. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We've already got an email from Catherine who says, I'd like to get ahead of the lily beetle. What can I spray the lilies with as they emerge next spring? Can you spray plants with both a bug repellent and rabbit repellent at the same time, or do they cancel each other out?
Well, that's a good question. I probably wouldn't do it at the same day. In other words, I wouldn't mix it together in my sprayer. I might do them several days apart, but I don't think they cancel each other out. For the lily leaf beetle, if you can be out there and when the lilies are emerging, and handpick the adult beetles as best you can, and the spray with, I use the Cap'n Jack's, the spinosad, It works. It's most effective against the larval stage. It's somewhat effective against the adults, but not tremendously. Handpicking works. I haven't had a real problem with lily leaf beetle in a number of years, but they, in some areas, they still are a big problem.
Yeah,
the major problem with my lilies are the rabbits.
Rabbits. You know, I've planted a lot more lilies since we've been seeing less of the lily leaf beetle, and
they've been.
I mean, they haven't had any beetles. They've had some other issues, but. But no lily leaf beetles. And my neighbor has done the same thing. And she has one little area in her yard where she seems to have them and not in the rest of her yard, which is interesting,
funny.
Right?
Yeah.
But yeah, and they're easy to spot, those red things. Just, grab them
and squish
them.
Well, they're so bright red. They do have a tendency. What I like to do is go out there with like a little tuna fish can or something and hold it sort of underneath where the beetle is, because as soon as you go to pick it off, it drops off the plant. they're crafty that way. So if I have like an old can or something with a little bit of soapy water in it, it's easy to catch the beetles when they drop if you can't catch them with your hands.
Yeah.
They're beautiful beetles.
They really are pretty. Yeah, they are. All right. Blight. Lots of people seeing some blight on their tomatoes.
Yeah, you know, while we haven't had a lot of rain, we have had a lot of days, as I said, where we've been in a fog. It's been misty or drizzly, and it's been so humid that if you have been irrigating, the foliage just doesn't dry off.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect conditions for blight. So I have seen the beginnings of it on my plants. I have gone out a couple of weeks ago, and I removed foliage from the lower approximately 12 to 18 inches of the stems. And this allows me to have good air circulation at the base of the plants. And it usually starts on the lower leaves. I also have sprayed with an actual fungicide. It's a material, the name escapes me at the moment. Hold on a second. It's called Fungonil. I have the bottle right here. And it's not organic. I'll be, quite honest about that. But it works as a preventative. So I removed the lower foliage, and I have sprayed the leaves of my plants. And I have a little bit. I mean, you should repeat the spraying according to the label directions. I've only done it once. I have not repeated it. But it serves to keep it in a manageable stage.
Mm-hmm.
There are organic materials available on the market that do have some efficacy in prevention, but I'm going for the big guns this year because I lost my tomatoes last year to blight because I had to water so often. The drought last year was even worse.
Yeah, I've not had any problems, knock on for Mike or whatever this is, with my tomatoes yet. They look pretty good, but I did, trim them up a little bit to kind of keep that airflow. So maybe that's a good suggestion that you made.
That's a good suggestion.
Yeah.
The other thing is I go out there every few days and I prune out the suckers.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are hesitant to do that. If you leave a lot of suckers, and you're growing them in a tomato cage, it creates a very crowded situation where you don't get the good airflow. And you really want good air circulation to keep the foliage relatively dry as possible in these humid days. So even if I have missed a sucker and it's now as big as my thumb, I'll go out there with a pair of pruning shears and just prune it out. And does it reduce the harvest? Not significantly.
Yeah. Dan has a question. He says they have their normal tomato plants, which he puts in pots. He and his wife put them in pots. And he said they look fabulous, but they've just now started flowering. And he's wondering why they're so late.
It's probably more a question of temperature than timing. We had very hot weather in June, and tomato flowers only pollinate between a fairly narrow temperature range. And anything much above 85, 86, 87, the flowers are there, but they just don't pollinate and you don't get tomatoes. I planted mine very early this year. I actually planted all my tomatoes on May 15th, and we had really wonderful temperatures, so I had a great fruit set. And now there was a gap from all those hot days where you can see all the fruit at on the plant sort of at the base, and then there's a big gap, and now it's forming fruit at the top. Mm-hmm. But because of that early planting, I've actually started harvesting, and I've had two BLTs already.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. I have some green tomatoes, but I'm a little – so Dan's got flowers. I've got some green tomatoes, and you've got the red ones.
It'll happen. It'll happen. Yeah. It is – ripening itself, once you get the tomatoes, ripening is a function of temperature. So the warmer it is, the faster they ripen. My problem is on those low-hanging tomatoes, rabbits get in there and start eating the green tomatoes. So now as soon as things look like they're going to be ripe, I pick them and let them finish on the shelf.
Yeah, good idea.
And they taste just as good.
Yeah, I've had that problem with my strawberries. We've gotten some, but I'm pretty sure it's rats that are nibbling on the many of the strawberries. And they don't even eat the whole thing. They eat a few bites out of each of the red ones, which is so frustrating.
yeah, chipmunks do that too, buggers.
Yeah. Dan also was talking about some basil that he has, and he said it looks like it has a little fungus. Sounds like he's describing some powdery mildew, which is another thing that we're seeing, right?
There's a lot of powdery mildew out on cucumbers, and I've seen pictures on the Cape Cod Gardening Facebook page. People are having powdery mildew on squash. On basil, it could be downy mildew, tends to wipe out your basil crop fairly early. I have pretty much restricted my basil to the disease-resistant varieties. Rutgers came out with three different cultivars. You can buy them at garden centers now, or you can order seed. One is called Devotion, one is called Obsession, and one is called Passion, I think is the third one. But they're all resistant to downy mildew. And I last year did a little experiment. I planted the disease resistant next to just straight basil, from six packs. And by August, I had lost my six pack basil, but the disease resistant was still producing in October. So I highly recommend going out of your way to find the disease resistant. Another one is Amazel basil. It's a proven winter product. It's also resistant to downy mildew. Disease-resistant plants are always, if you can, are the best way to go. Mm. I do have one disease problem in my tomatoes, and I took a chance using this one particular bed where I've had the problem in the past, and it's verticillium wilt. Mm. And so I have a couple of old-fashioned, non-disease-resistant varieties. They don't have blight. They have wilt. They're turning yellow and just... I'm going to lose them.
Oh, boy. So even if Dan cuts off those leaves that have the downy mildew, it's probably still not going to do well?
It's probably not going to do well.
Yeah. Pull it out, Dan. Put in a new one.
Yep.
See, you can go get a potted one somewhere, right, and just replace it.
Yes, you can. Many of the... garden centers now have basil in large pots. They're fairly good-sized plants, so definitely you can replace your basil that you're going to possibly lose because of downy mildew.
Yeah, it's funny because I have an herb garden where I usually plant my basil. Last couple of years, it hasn't done so great there. I have some in there, and it still kind of remained small, but I put two other plants in much sunnier locations. They're doing great. And the ones that have just been kind of, and they're sort of a lighter green, they're just now really starting to maybe get a few more leaves, but they've just sort of been sitting there doing nothing, which has been kind of weird. Yeah.
Disappointing to say the least.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Not gonna get all that pesto that I thought I was going to have.
Yep. I actually made pesto last week.
Did you? Wow.
So far this year, I was late on some things. In fact, I never got my early crop of green beans in. too many other things were going on in my life. But I now, the peas are, I had a fabulous crop of peas, but they're ready to be pulled out, and mm-hmm. we're going to put green beans in, hopefully this afternoon or sometime this week. And I'll be picking green beans in September.
Yep.
So, you know, it's never too late to get another crop in.
Sure. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It is Gardening Today with horticulturist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number for your garden questions, comments, tips. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have an email from Paula in Kituit who says, I water my vegetable garden with a soaker hose. Is there a way to measure the amount of water?
That's a conundrum. I used to use soaker hoses at the demonstration garden at the fairgrounds, and I never came up with a good method for measuring output. So I relied on the old run it for a specific length of time and then stick my fingers in the dirt, literally, mm-hmm. to see how deep the moisture had penetrated. And you would love it to go down about 4 inches, mm-hmm. Which may mean you run your system a little longer than you think. I think drip irrigation is a great way to water because it reduces the amount of moisture on foliage, so it does reduce disease problems. And it's a little more efficient than using overhead. The overhead sprinkler, you know, a lot of that water is lost to evaporation. So it's the old feel the soil mm-hmm. and sort of keep track of how long it's been running and make a judgment call.
Right. Pat in Yarmouth says, my lettuces are past and I have a big empty spot to welcome something new into the garden. What do you suggest?
Well, that's a great question because right now, mid-July, is an excellent time to start thinking about what you'd like to be harvesting in the fall. I just said I'm going to be planting green beans. So if you are harvesting your green beans now, but you would like to continue that for the summer, definitely plant another row of green beans. Kale, this is a perfect time to grow another crop of kale. And I'm basically talking about things that you can direct seed right into your garden at this mm-hmm. point. Because if you go to most garden centers, they really don't have a lot of vegetables available at this point. But the soil is very warm right now, and if you can keep a seed bed moist, you can get germination fairly quickly. So heat-tolerant lettuce, kale, escarole, green
carrots,
beans,
carrots.
Another row of beets. I'm planting more beets because my rabbits ate mine yesterday.
Oh, dear.
Carrots,
yep. Mm-hmm.
So fennel for fall harvest. You could actually get another crop of things like broccoli, kohlrabi. So a number of things that you can plant in the garden. Mid-July is just a wonderful time, if you can provide the moisture, mm-hmm. To seed. And I tell people, look at seed packets, anything from, 60 to 70 days to harvest, and we've got plenty of time. We have such a great fall season. It's good to plant now for that.
I would say I've harvested carrots in November and December.
Yes,
yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, so carrots are a good one. And if you have kids around,
lots of fun.
Yeah, and like you said, the green beans, super easy to grow. We mentioned the powdery mildew, downy mildew, and blight. Anything else we're seeing that we should be aware of?
I have seen powdery mildew on a number of things. It's showing up on phlox. It's showing up on bee balm in the perennial garden. The thing about powdery mildew, it's what they call an obligate parasite. It needs a living host, so it doesn't actually kill the plant, mm-hmm. but it does weaken it. There are a number of materials based on baking soda, potassium bicarbonate, that work very well to prevent new infections. So if you're not growing a disease-resistant variety of phlox or bee balm or what have you, next year you might want to start earlier and use one of those potassium bicarbonate-based materials on your plants, and it will prevent the downy mildew from forming, powdery mildew from forming.
Yeah. Some of my lilies have sort of brown spots on the actual flowers. Is that is that from the moisture, the humidity?
That's from the moisture.
Yeah, I figured.
You know, we are seeing, you know, as I walk around my yard, I'm seeing various leaf spots on a number of different plants. When you do have many days in a row where it's the atmosphere is either so humid or we've had these misty, foggy days, it's really difficult to prevent diseases from occurring.
Yeah. You know, I have a honeysuckle vine that's up against the house, so there's really nothing else around it. And it last year and the year before, it looked like sooty mold, and I noticed it again this year. Is it in the soil or something coming back? Is there something I need to do to you know, head it off for next year?
Unbeknownst to you, you probably had aphids.
Oh.
I had a big outbreak of aphids on one of my honeysuckles in particular, Mandarin. It's a bright orange. Oh, my goodness. It's an absolute beautiful, beautiful plant. And I noticed that the foliage was becoming a little distorted and off color, and then I got a lot of sooty mold, and I took a close look, and I had tons of aphids.
Oh, aphids.
So I cut off most of it. I mean, it grows like a weed, literally. I cut it way back, and you know, I also had a lot of lady beetles that were starting to appear, so I let that just go. But anytime you see sooty mold on a plant, it indicates the presence of a sucking insect like aphids or leaf hoppers or mealybug. So if you examine the plant or sometimes I've seen this happen where there's like a branch overhanging a particular plant and the plant has sooty mold, the insect isn't actually on that plant. It's on whatever the tree branch overhanging it is.
Yeah.
And sooty mold is unsightly. It cuts down on photosynthesis, but it's not damaging in and of itself.
Yeah, so I guess I should check that in the spring, look for them, because, I mean, now it's past bloom. So, okay, because I did cut it back a couple years ago. I cut it way back, but they're back.
They grow like, they literally, I have a lot of, I think I have six different cultivars of our native honeysuckle that the hummingbirds absolutely love, but they are quite vigorous.
Yes.
So I do, every few years, I give them a really good trimming, and they come right back.
Yeah, they sure do, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Boy, do we have a lot of earwigs this year.
Oh, you know.
They're everywhere.
They are everywhere. And the really interesting thing about earwigs is, in my opinion, they cause a lot of damage, particularly to seedlings, that gets blamed on other insects. But I find that earwigs can be quite damaging, particularly with newly sown seedlings. They just skeletonize leaves. An effective way, at least in the vegetable garden, to deter them is to use diatomaceous earth. And every once a week or every couple of weeks, sprinkle the soil around the plant and even sprinkle the foliage itself with the diatomaceous earth, the agricultural, horticultural grade diatomaceous earth, not the kind you use in a pool. And it's quite effective at discouraging them. They're weird little critters. I've never been fond of earwigs.
No, they just look so creepy. Well, you know, the
yes,
funny thing
do.
Is, like, even and they get into everything. It's like, you know, you put the bathing suits on the clothesline to dry off, and I'm always having to check them to make sure they're not full of earwigs when I take
yes.
them down.
Or you cut a head of lettuce and you bring it in.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I always try to turn it upside down and give it a good vigorous shaking before I bring it in, because when I put it in the sink to wash it, you know, half a dozen earwigs come out. Ugh,
yeah, same
don't
thing.
Like that.
They like my dahlias as well. So, yeah, you have
they
to
They always
check
like dahlias
yeah.
and peonies, yeah.
yeah.
Dahlias look beautiful this year.
Oh, my dahlias are doing great. I'm very excited about that. What about slugs? Are we seeing a lot of slugs?
I haven't seen as many slugs as I normally do, and I'm attributing that to it's been relatively dry.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get right down into foliage, particularly in shaded area, they're out there. I'm not having a bad year with slugs or snails. My worst enemies are the rabbits.
Yeah, I know a lot of rabbits. It seems like there's a bumper crop of rabbits this year. They're another thing that's everywhere, right?
Well, I have 7 raised beds for my vegetables, and I have fenced them in individually with plastic snow fencing, and it's a heavy grade plastic, and I've done this for 3 or 4 years now and been very successful with it. This year, the rabbits are literally chewing holes through the fencing
wow.
and getting into my beds. That's why I went out yesterday, and they had gotten into the bed where the beets were, and the beets are gone.
Mm.
So I'm going to have to rethink my rabbit proofing and maybe go over to some sort of metal mesh next year.
Yeah.
It's harder to work with, probably more expensive, but, you know, I'm going to beat these buggers if it kills me.
Yeah. What, I mean, is there anything you can do to rat-proof your gardens? I mean, you know, the rats, they can climb. They can get into small spaces. That's tough, right?
Yeah, I have not really, knock on wood, I have not had rats in my garden. Chipmunks, which are almost as bad, and they can climb over. I haven't had them. They usually get into the tomatoes as they're ripening, which is another reason I sometimes pick them a little early and let them finish on my kitchen shelf. You could use... you know, this sounds horrible, and I may be criticized for it, but you can use snap traps.
Mm.
A lot of people say get a have-a-heart trap, but according to Massachusetts law, if you capture an animal in a live trap, it is illegal to take it for a ride and release
somewhere
else.
And you know what? There are just so many of them. I mean, if you find one rat, you know you've got a lot of them around. So, I don't think
you
the
do.
Snap traps
and
would work
if,
so much
if
for
I
me.
I don't but, like to recommend using the anticoagulant type of rat bait.
Right.
Because if the rat dies out in the open and
can kill another animal,
a predator bird or any other predator feeds on the dead animal that's been killed with a anticoagulant, it can also kill the raptor. So I don't recommend. That's why I say, you know, snap traps don't sound very nice.
But they're better than the poison,
But they're better than the poison.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's...
But the prevention, you know, if you're still feeding your birds,
The problem is I have a neighbor that feeds birds, and I can't really tell her what to do in her yard.
Well,
but,
you know, the other thing is a lot of folks have chickens these days.
And they attract rats,
If someone has chickens, they will also have rats because they're attracted to the grain.
Yeah.
The other thing that, and I'm sure Mark could maybe has discussed this, but there is a new disease of birds that has been detected. It's not, as far as I know, it's not in Massachusetts yet. But it has been advised for people to take down their feeders and take away their bird baths. Avoid having places where birds congregate together.
Mm-hmm.
So... to hopefully prevent this particular, I believe it's a virus, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and they're not really sure what it is yet. So, yeah, right. But we did talk about that last
there.
Bird news. Yeah, it's out there, but not in Massachusetts yet.
You're right.
The Mass Division of something or other is asking.
Wildlife, I believe.
Yeah, is asking people to take them
They've
down.
They've asked that we don't feed the birds. So I actually stopped feeding my birds in April because of rats, and I don't resume feeding them until almost November. So I'm a winter bird feeder, and I love my birds, but
I haven't fed the birds for years now because of the rats. We've done all the preventative stuff that you can do. I think I'm just going to have to learn to live with a few rats. And now we have the dog, and I have to say the dog's been helpful because the dog does chase them, you know.
I don't think
the rats like having the dog in the yard, so maybe that'll be helpful. Yeah.
I do have a friend, she lives off Cape, who was plagued with rats, and she went the snap trap route, and she put a temporary halt to the population in her yard. She was rat-free for about 6 weeks. She did see one the other day, so you're never totally free of them. They will come back.
Yeah, and you know, I tend to think that the rats that you would get in something that would be the young ones, because they're very smart.
Yes,
and the older
are.
Ones don't fall for it, you know, just the younger ones. So, yeah, let's talk to Elise, who's giving us a call from Aquinnah. Hi, Elise.
Hi.
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 This is my first year with an irrigation system, and a friend told me that it was bad for my plants because it doesn't go deep enough, and it's better to dry them out and do a deep soaking. Is that true?
That is true. Most irrigation systems are set to go on every other day for like 15 or 20 minutes, and that's actually inadequate. It's too often and not enough water, and it encourages roots to stay up in that upper horizon of the soil. So if we do get a water ban, they're going to be more impacted because they don't have deep roots. It's better to, if you can adjust the timing of your system, have it only go off once or maybe twice a week, and put some rain gauges out there to measure output, and water deeply once or twice a week rather than a little bit every couple of days.
Okay, I have heavy mulch, and I have it on for an hour 4 days a week. Does that
That's too much.
Make any difference? Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank
You're
you for
welcome.
The call, Elise. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Gardening with horticulturist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Paul writes, I have a Coosa dogwood, and I want to know when to prune it, and any advice for pruning, mixed advice online.
Any pruning should be done in late winter or early spring. And I'm assuming this is a young tree that he wants to train. And basically, it's sort of the same. You would look for good, well-spaced branches. Prune out any that are crossing or rubbing, or any that are too close together on the trunk. Generally, coosas don't require a lot of pruning at all, but the time to do it would be late winter, early spring.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Hydrangeas. It's been a good year for hydrangeas, but I have the funniest thing that happened. I have three blue hydrangeas along the side of my house. One of them is white. They've been there for years. It's never been white. It's white this year.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I can explain that.
And you know, I thought maybe it's something in this soil, but you know, there's a couple of them that have a little bit of blue in the middle of the flower, but they're pretty much most of the flowers are white. And I thought, how odd is that?
that
all these
odd.
Years it's been blue and now it's
something's going on in the soil.
Yeah.
It was an excellent year and still is an excellent year for hydrangeas. We've just finished the Hydrangea Fest, and it was a great year because hydrangeas just looked absolutely gorgeous, the blue hydrangeas.
Mm-hmm.
And the paniculatas are just now starting to come into bloom, and they will be the star of the show until fall.
Yeah, I have a limelight hydrangea that I just love. Boy, is that
a
beautiful
one.
Hydrangea. The flowers are just gorgeous, and it grows pretty quickly, I think. You know, some of the other ones take a little while, but that one seemed to grow on the
The limelight gets to be fairly large as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I grow one called Little Lime, and it's the quote-unquote dwarf version of limelight, and it's equally as lovely.
Mm. I had another interesting issue in my garden. I got this little raised bed, you know, a small one that's like, you know, off the ground, like 4 feet. I thought, well, I'll give this little thing a try. And then I have my two beds on the ground next to it. Everything in my beds on the ground are fabulous. You know, green looks great. Everything there's only cucumbers, there's some yellow beans and carrots. The green, all of the green in there is a lighter green. And I'm wondering, and the soil is the same, but could it be something, it's just that it's not deep enough, or it's the wood that it's in? What do you think?
It could be that it's like growing in container. You're basically growing in a container.
Like a container, yeah.
I would just, if the color, the foliage color is a lighter color, you might want to give it a, you know, a little fertilization.
Mm-hmm.
It perks up.
Yeah.
And I think any time you're growing in an above ground container, you also have to pay a little more attention to watering.
I water it every day because it's just not that deep. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they dry
out. You water your containers, right? So yeah.
Exactly. Try fertilizing it.
Yeah, I'll try that and see what happens. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Any other little critters? We mentioned earwigs. And are we seeing any other issues with
Japanese
critters?
Japanese beetles are out.
Oh, right, yes.
Oriental beetles are out there. Prionus beetle adults are out, and people are shocked at how big they are. They're probably, I'm going to say maybe about 2 inches long. Big brown beetle with very large mandibles, so they're rather alarming to see. And also, if they fly into your screen at night, they made a very loud thunk.
Yeah.
So they're also called a broad-necked root borer. That is the common name. So they're never present in large enough numbers to do a lot of damage. But, you know, they're an interesting beetle to see. Cucumber beetles are quite active. Squash vine borer is flying now, laying eggs on the stems of your squash. I have to say, I'm growing zephyr squash. I've grown it every year for a long time now. And I am just, I think next year it's the only one I'm going to grow. It just is amazingly productive. It's very pretty. The top is yellow and the bulb part at the base is green.
Mm-hmm.
Very firm when you cook it, nutty flavored, just very delicious.
Wow.
So that's coming in gangbusters now. I need to do something preventatively for vine borer because the adults are flying now. I have seen some damage on the edges of rhododendron foliage, which indicates black vine weevil adults mm-hmm. are feeding. The usual assortment.
The usual
pest characters, yes.
I have to say, my zucchini is crazy big. I just planted one zucchini and one yellow squash next to each other, and that zucchini in my little 4x6 bed is taking up practically the entire bed, and I've already had several zucchinis from it. It's doing gangbusters, which is nice. All right, let's talk to Lance, who's giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Lance.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about a crop that I didn't plant. Mushrooms, they're all over the place. What's going on? Is there something wrong?
No, mushrooms are a natural part of the environment. They're present all year, but the bulk of a mushroom is made up of teeny tiny microscopic strands called mycelium that are present in the soil. And when conditions are correct, particularly when it's damp, misty, and wet, then you get mushrooms popping up, particularly if you're irrigating your lawn. I've seen lots of mushrooms as I do my travels around the Cape. Most of them don't cause any damage to your lawn or to your garden. They are actually developing on decaying organic material in the soil, so I generally don't worry about them. I don't recommend that people, unless they really know what they're doing, don't eat them. Buy your mushrooms at the grocery store, because there are some out there that are deadly poison.
Yeah.
And if you do have them growing in your yard, and you have dogs that are running around in the yard, I generally will go out and collect them and just get them out of the yard. I don't want my dogs to accidentally ingest them.
Yeah. Lance, thanks for the phone call. Tim is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I have a question about cutworms. They got my tomatoes, they got my cucumbers, melons, the tomatoes, cannabis, everything.
That's very disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same, like, 4x12 that I do every year, and I'm just letting it lie fallow and doing
everything. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Do you... Are you planting from seed, or are you planting from transplants?
Well, everything they got was from seed and growing under lights all spring and all that.
Yeah.
But
and then you transplanted
after
out.
After they killed everything, I went and got a bunch of starts.
Yeah, next year what I would do is, when you transplant everything into the garden, just really douse that lower stem with some Cap'n Jacks. And if you're not comfortable with the, you don't think that's going to do a good enough job, that's the organic product, you could use something that has permethrin in it, something like 8 is the commercial name. It's not organic, but it will definitely take care of cutworms. If they try to take a bite, they will be poisoned. And just treat the lower stems for a couple of weeks until the stems get large enough that they're no longer attractive to the cutworms.
Yeah, Jenny's saying she uses a cutworm cup. She said the paper cup around the plant base.
Yep, I've seen people do that, and it does work. Cut out the bottom of the paper cup and insert the lower end into the soil, and the cup usually will extend up at least a couple of inches, depending on the size cup you use. That also works. I've had people who've been quite successful wrapping the stem with newspaper.
Mm.
I've also had people who've been successful using like a craft stick or a popsicle stick, and as they plant their transplant, they insert that into the soil directly against the stem, because apparently the cutworms sort of curl them their way around stem in order to feed, and that prevents them from doing that. So there are a lot of little non-chemical ways you can try to prevent them.
Yeah, Tim, thanks for the phone call. Good luck with that. Kristen is asking, I have 3 hydrangeas along the side of my house. The one in the center has plenty of blooms. The other 2 have great-looking leaves, but maybe 1 or 2 blooms. Any ideas?
Interesting. Some difference in microclimate, maybe some difference in exposure to wind in the winter, which would dry out flower buds, or just a fluke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got another question about hydrangeas. Peggy from Orleans says, could you please tell me how to get my oak leaf hydrangeas to flower? They are in the shade.
They are a good plant for partial shade, so... It might be they're in too much shade. I have one planted in a woodland garden, and it has never bloomed because it is just too shady, whereas I have another one in that same garden that's planted out on the edge of the garden, and it gets dappled sunlight, and part of it actually gets a little bit of afternoon sun, and that blooms like crazy. So it's probably a question of not getting enough sunlight, and that could be remedied by either transplanting it to a better location or maybe doing some selective limbing up or pruning mm-hmm. of the surrounding trees so more sunlight penetrates.
Jenny asks, is it too late to plant zucchini or other squashes at this point?
No, it's not. If you are running out of zucchini, although I don't think anyone ever runs out of zucchini, it's a great time to put in a crop that's going to be producing in September. So, yes, go ahead and plant zucchini and summer squash now.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking about adding a couple of trees to my yard, and one of the trees I've been eyeing is the rising sun redbud, the more dwarf one than the big giant redbuds. And I've noticed a couple of folks on the Cape Cod Gardening Facebook page having some, you know, not lasting, you know, only a couple of years. Somebody said 5 years before it you know, didn't,
that was me.
That was you? So what happened?
That was me.
That made me curious because I thought they were pretty hardy. Are they not?
They are wonderful plants. It's absolutely gorgeous, but they are subject to verticillium wilt.
Oh.
All red buds are, not just the rising sun. And I don't know why, but I have verticillium wilt in my soil about 5 or 6 feet, maybe more, away from where I had the rising sun planted. It was an absolutely beautiful American smoke bush, mm-hmm. Cotinus obovatus, absolutely gorgeous. I got it from the Arnold Arboretum. It also is subject to verticillium, and it's dying one limb after another.
Oh.
And I mentioned my tomatoes, which are also maybe 10-20 feet away from that area, are also subject to a little bit of verticillium. So it's a soil-borne fungus, and it took out my rising sun. And the symptoms are it just... For the first few years, it looked absolutely gorgeous. It grew beautifully. And then I noticed one branch dying, and then another branch Uh-oh. Died. And the following year, a couple of more branches died. And then it just, you know, I cut a branch that was starting to wilt. And if you take a sharp knife and expose the vascular tissue with a nice long diagonal cut, you'll see the vascular tissue inside the branch, which is where the water is transported within a plant, was brown.
Oh.
And that's a diagnostic clue for verticillium.
Oh.
And so I cut it down.
Yeah. So, what would be some other options, or do you think I should go ahead and try the rising sun in my yard?
You know, I would say go ahead and try it. Verticillium isn't everywhere,
mm-hmm.
And it may be that your soil does not have verticillium in it, in which case the rising sun would be an absolutely gorgeous tree to grow in your yard. But if after a few years you notice a few branches beginning to wilt and die, you might suspect that it's not a long-lived plant in your yard.
Yeah. All right. Having a question from a listener starting a garden from scratch, and she'd just like to know some basic things to keep in mind as she's planning this new garden.
Organic matter. Put in as much organic matter as you can initially, and either incorporate more organic matter in on an annual basis, either by, if it's a vegetable garden, you can turn it in. If it's a perennial garden, you can top dress with compost on an annual basis. With our soils being mostly on the sandy side, we really need to work in, if you're going to be successful, you really need to work in organic material, some kind of compost or well-rotted manure, and it needs to be replenished on a regular basis.
Yeah. The other thing I would say in planning is think about what that plant will be when it's at its full grown state, right? We always have this tendency to kind of plant things too close together, and then we say, what happened? Yeah, where is that daylily I had? Oh, wait, it's underneath all this other stuff, right? So you want to think about what the full size will be when it's...
I am notorious for doing that, knowing full well that at some point I'm going to have to thin out my plants. Knowing the eventual... height and width, just how big a plant is going to be, allows you to plant them properly spaced. You can always fill in the areas with, you know, annuals or something like that, that, you know, you don't have to plant once the plant gets big. But, yeah, knowing, and the other thing, if you're doing this with perennials or shrubs, know what they like. How much sun do they like? How much shade do they prefer? And try to match the plant to your growing conditions, because it's difficult to manipulate the growing conditions match the plant after the fact.
Horticulturist Roberta Clark joins us the third Tuesday of the month. Thank you, Roberta. Talk to you next month.
My pleasure. See you then.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.